Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. This time we begin the tech nets we've done for the last, 1982 to now 36 years. I think by now we'd be getting tired of it. Well, there's always new amateurs joining the clan. There's always new kinds of ham radio being invented. So there's always new things to be discussed. This TechNet is a gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about how radio and wireless equipment works, how propagation works, the magic of the action at a distance. You press your key down on Long Island, and in theory, a guy in Japan hears your Morse code 12,000 miles away. All the magic as to how all that happens. The TechNet is broken up into roughly three sections. The first section is moderated by K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And people sign in with their questions and comments, give us their call letters, their name, and we take them in order. That's the first third. Approximately third. The second third is by Dr. Roy, AC2GS, who gives us a science talk. And so he's always got a significant list of things that have been in the science journals lately, and he brings that to our attention and gives it his spin, and we're allowed to ask him as many questions about what he is talking about. Don't feel that you're interrupting him if you want to make a comment or have a further question for clarification on anything that he says. He's disappointed if people just sit there and listen quietly. He likes participation, so please participate. Please join the crowd if you don't.
Repeater, timeout.
Definitely put in your 2 cents worth if you have anything to comment on or further questions on what Roy says. The third section is by Paul, WS2N, the Space Report. I have the impression that Paul has become enthralled with space equipment and NASA operations at an early age. And my goodness, does he keep track of every launch and the name of every one of those vehicles. He must have a bunch of charts in his house that show you all those sections of the International Space Station, where they're all arranged and what they look like and what they do and how they got there and how long they've been there. The International Space Station is by far the biggest piece of hardware in space that has ever been created. It's bigger than a football field, including the end zones. So it takes up, I guess, more than an acre of property, weighs almost 1 million pounds. And all that hardware was put up there one piece at a time and assembled. Quite a project. Okay, there was a flea market at Levittown Hall today, and any of the people who attended, we'd like to hear from you. What did you see? What did you like? What did you not like? What's the good piece of hardware that got away? What's the great bargain that you got? I think both Paul and Roy probably were there, so we'll be hearing from them as to what they saw and what it was like. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins by people who do have a question or a comment for the first section of the TechNet. Try to remember to hold off and press the button immediately. Wait for the three beeps, the four beeps, which resets all of the complicated system we've got here of Echo Link and IRLP. You could easily time it out if you talk to the mic too soon, if you press the mic too soon. So if you have a question or a comment, give me a call letters right now. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And give me your call letters and name after the beeps.
And here we go. This is it. Kilowatts. Dick, I will answer the question.
URIW, this is N2AAM, Dave Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey. Yes, with a question.
Okay, we picked up Rich, N2EO, and Dave, W2AAM from New Jersey. Anyone else to check in who has a question or a comment? Please send me your call letters right now and name. Wait for the beep. K2RIW listening.
82HUC, Steve, and yes.
Kilowatt 6. Dick, W82CDL. I know people are not really waiting for the beep. But I'd like to go first, and it's about reaching the ballot. I can't stay on long because I have to go up, go to work tomorrow and get up really early. I want to give you a follow-up of what Roy and I saw today on a test we made. So if that's okay with you, I'd like to go before Richie. He'll probably be talking about it anyway. WA2CDL.
Dick, I'd like to get in at all possible.
Okay, that time we picked up Steve and Andy. And for a small fee, we'll let Andy go first. Now let's see if we have anyone else to check in. K2RIW, TechNet listening. Give me your call letters and name if you're not on the list just yet.
Al Goretzky, K60.
Okay, we've got more than enough to get starting. So Andy, did this testing take place at the flea market? Since you and Roy were together, it sounds like that's what happened. So tell me a little about what you saw. V2CDL. The guy who used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. K2RIW. You got Andy?
Alright, thank you, Dick. I'm listening to myself, so I get an idea what's going on. Alright, so the bottom line to this whole business with Richie's Ballon is going back to August now, when I first saw this issue. And I saw that the... I'm going to wait. I saw the issue with the... I fixed it. I'll keep on talking anyway, because I know you can hear me. Alright, so to speed things up, because of what's going on, the test showed that the new Ballon that Richie bought is showing identical results as compared to the original Ballon. It would make sense that you were right as far as the resistors, the 200 ohm resistor or 250 ohm resistor that I was using have too much inductance and is throwing me off. I want to make more tests with a proper non-inductive load. I recently picked up one of those Rig Expert antenna analyzers, and it's a very good one. It's a lot better than the MFJ that I have. So I brought it with me to the flea market, and we did this test at the flea market today, since I had a little bit of time, and to prove. If my load is the proper load, and if the Ballon is working properly.
Repeater, timeout.
Alright, let me get the beep. Alright. So, the bottom line to what we saw today is that the new Ballon and the original Ballon are giving identical results. As far as the SWR being high, in regard to the resistor that I was using, I do have a 200 ohm high power 100 watt, or at least in this case a 50 watt resistor, but I believe it's a wire wound resistor, and it has inductance to it. And I remember we spoke about that, Dick, as far as the inductance. You did a calculation. Your calculation proved that the resistor's inductance is throwing off the response of the Ballon itself. I'm going to be making more tests, but I have to come up with a proper load that's non-inductive just to prove that the Ballon is actually good and there's nothing wrong with it. Because I had Richie buy another Ballon, a second one, and that might not be necessary. Now, so now I have two Ballons. The original one and the new one. So I want to make one more test, but I have to come up with this proper load and then see what the results are with that. Why this problem originally started, I have no idea. I don't know what happened that caused it. We do know that there were other things that happened because of the amplifier that was used, and that was further down the line. So that's where we stand right now.
I didn't mean to have Richie go out and buy a second ballot because of inaccurate results due to the fact that we didn't have the proper load.
Repeater, time out.
All right, let me get the beep again. All right. And let me just, hold on a second. That's better. I just realized I was on low power, that's why I was noisy. So, I apologize for having somebody go out and buy something they didn't have to buy. But it's proving a point with the test that we're making. So, that's where we stand right now, Dick. Again, when you made that calculation, it looked like that you were right on target as far as the load not being the right load. All right, back to you for any comments on your end. And may you, and Roy may have something to say about it also because we were together today. K2RAW, WHCDO.
Jack, AC2GS.
I'm going to plug in a couple of comments and I'm going to pass it over to Roy. What Andy had done is the 4-to-1 balance made by Talstar. It's supposed to be 50 ohms input, 200 ohms of output, which probably feeds the Cobra antenna that N2EO Rich owns. So to test that balance, Andy has a 200 ohm resistor that's rated for 100 watts, and he was going to put that as a load on the 200 ohm output of the balance and measure the 50 ohm input. And Andy had independently measured just the 200 ohm resistor and found out it had 5 microhenries of inductance because it's wire wound. At first, that sounds like a small number. You go through the mathematics, 2 pi FL, the inductive reactance of 5 microhenries is 440 ohms. So you had 440 ohms of inductive reactance and 200 ohms of resistance in series with each other. That's what's really inside of the 200 ohm resistor that at first they used as a dummy load. You go through the mathematics of that, and you'll find out that it's a 6.6-to-1 standing wave ratio. A dummy load has got to be a pure resistor, and if it's got 440 ohms of inductive reactance, which should be zero inductive reactance, along with the 200 ohms of resistance, you go through the mathematics, that's a 6.6 VISWAP. So putting that as a dummy load on the Palstar Ballon gives you an extremely high reflection coefficient of a 6.6 VISWAP, plus whatever else is in there. And so that gives you a false alarm that the Ballon was defective. In reality, the Ballon, the two Ballons were probably identical, and at 14 megahertz, when you measure that, it's a bad but not sufficient test, if you know what I mean. So I think Andy is going to eventually find, let me drop this. If he hasn't already done so, he's going to find a way of creating 200 ohms of pure resistance as a load on the output of the Ballon. There's various ways of doing that with the equipment that he owns. Then measure the input impedance of that Ballon on a network analyzer or antenna analyzer and find out, is there really a difference in those two Ballons? The Cobra antenna manufacturer does recommend not using that particular Palstar Ballon. So tell me a little bit about what the flea market was like. Don't tell me the place was a little bit crowded and you were shoulder to shoulder with all those people in the Levittown Hall, Roy. What was it like? I didn't get a chance to go. So what was the flea market like, and what did you see when those tests were being done at Andy's test station at the flea market? AC2GS, Science Talk, ma'am, Agent Maven. And this is Science, K2RIW. You got it, Roy.
A6DPC, we'd like to talk about balance and testing. We've designed them.
Jack Williams. And I really enjoyed the Hamfest a great deal. I'm not really a buyer at most of the interesting old equipment, but I tend to like my stuff new and shiny, unfortunately for my bank book. So I enjoyed meeting and greeting people, guys that I talk to on the radio, guys that I don't talk to on the radio. As I babbled on, people recognized my voice, actually, and came by to say that they really liked the text nets and the Science Talk and such and the space report. So that was fun as well. Let me drop for a sec.
By the way, were you wearing some kind of a sign identifying yourself, Roy? Go ahead.
Well, I had a little ID badge on my sweatshirt. I wore a Ohm's Law. It's the law, it's not a suggestion sweatshirt. But I think people recognize the voice.
Okay, go right ahead with what you were describing, what you saw during the test with Andy.
Yes, very good. AC2GS, by the way. I think the impedance was even higher because it was registering over 10 to 1 VISWA, beyond about 1 megahertz. We sweeped it from 1 megahertz all the way to 25 megahertz, and beyond 1 megahertz, it just went up and off the needle. I was thinking, though, there might be a very simple, quick, and dirty way of doing this with a standard 50-ohm dummy load. As long as Andy has both balanced, he can hook them up symmetrically and feed the 50-ohm in one. It comes out 200 ohms. It goes in the other 200-ohm input and comes out another 50 ohms. So he might be able to use both balance to test if both balance are working correctly. If one of them is malfunctioning, he'll get screwy results, but if they're both working, it should indicate that, I would think.
I believe I agree with you, Roy. Most of the time, if the balance was really pure, 50 ohms in, 200 ohms output, and you put a pair of them back to back like that, coming back to 50 ohms into a real 50 ohm load, that should work well. There's a very rare experience, though, where some kind of a resonance takes place between the two balance that can give you a phony result. If the balance do have, if there's a difference between the two, you're going to, I guess it's a necessary but not sufficient. In other words, if you get a good load doing that, 99% of the time, I think you're home free. But if you don't get a good load doing that, finding out is one of them bad, which one, I mean, just by reversing the two, that's not going to tell you anything. The most sophisticated test is a pure 200 ohm resistor, but back-to-back is a good test. Did you guys get a chance to do that one, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
Well, unfortunately, I just kind of thought of it now as I was listening to Andy. It probably would have been an interesting thing to do in addition, because I believe that Andy had a 50-ohm dummy load available for the process, but I didn't think of it that back then.
Yeah, at Andy's tune-up clinic that he's done now for years and years, and he's doing it now at other the flea markets, up in New Hampshire, down in Carolina, as well as on Long Island. He obviously has a high-powered dummy load at 50 ohms because I noticed to test people's transmitters at his tune-up station, at his analysis station, he'd have to be putting them under a load. So that he's got, and you could have done that. Were there any other tests that you guys did run with the equipment he had available there, right? AC2GS, K2RIW?
No, we basically ran the balance connected to the resistor, and then we decided to just test the resistor by itself, and that's when it's very self-evident that we were dealing with an inductive load.
And Andy did use some rather simple, not vector, but non-vector, what do you call it, scalar. He used a scalar testing piece of equipment to measure whether or not his 200 ohm dummy load resistor, wire wound, 100 watt rating, whether or not had any inductance. And he got an inductance at 14 megahertz, apparent inductance, at whatever frequency he measured it, apparent inductance of 5 microhenries. At first it sounds like a small number, but at 14 megs, that's a big number. That's a lot of inductive reactance, which shouldn't be there on a good dummy load. And a scalar piece of equipment looking at a complex load will give you an answer. It'll tell you some number of microhenries, that's not necessarily what it really is, if you know what I mean. Only a vector testing device will give you an answer that's thoroughly reliable. So the fact that you guys saw more than a 6.6 to 1 standing wave ratio when using that dummy load is not out of the question, if you know what I mean. Maybe it really has 10 microhenries, not 5 microhenries of inductance. So right now, according to the testing you've done with the marginal test equipment, I guess it does say that the two Palstar balance might be similar, but whether or not they're bad, we're not quite sure yet. See if Andy's got any further things he wants to say about all this. The Basu CDL, our balance scientist, K2RIW. Go ahead, Andy.
A6DCZ with a comment. To me, Derek, will you?
all left to be done. So, we'll eventually be getting Rich back on the air. Let me drop. We'll be getting Rich back on the air as these individual divide and conquer tests are done. And it's an educational process that we're all learning about. The number of amateurs that you and I can go to where you tell them the load is 440 ohms of inductive reactance in series with 200 ohms of resistance, all at 14 megahertz, and that's supposed to be a 200 ohm dummy load, and you put that on the end of a balun, what should you measure? That's sort of a sophomore or junior level of electrical engineering at a college where they really teach you how to do that. However, there is a section of the antenna of the radio amateur's handbook that, with a bit of study, would figure out how to do that. You'd be doing it with a diagram of a right triangle.
Repeater, timeout.
You'll be drawing a diagram of a right triangle, where one of the arms would be the 200 ohms at right angles. The other arm would be the 440 ohms of inductive reactance. The hypotenuse would be the total impedance. And now to calculate that into a standing wave ratio, you do it by selecting, you subtract the 200 ohms from that complex impedance on the top, add 200 ohms on the bottom, do a complex divide, find out what is the total reflection coefficient, that's called rho, and then 1 plus rho or 1 minus rho is called standing wave ratio. With a bit of study, a person using the radio amateur's handbook could do that. The total number of amateurs from the sound of my voice that would do it and feel comfortable with it probably is only about 5 or 10%. And one of the first guys doing that would be Mike, WY2U, and teaching people how to do it. Okay, let's see what Rich is going to say about all of the above. It looks like we're making progress step by step, Rich. Hang in there. You'll eventually have all your equipment on this particular band back on the air. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, sir, Steve, you're about to make a comment.
Okay, Dick. N2EO.
DPZ would like to make a comment. Dick, what is it?
Well, you know, what precipitated the problem? I know when I left the lake, shut everything down one day, you know, it was fine. Next day, I fired it up, and all hell broke loose. So I don't know why. By the way, I found that Palomar engineers make even a bigger balance. I may buy it as a fan. Same rating as the Palstar balance. 2,000 watts, side bam, 1,500 watts CW. Now, I don't know if this means anything. Much bigger box. 6 by 6 by 6. They also have what we were talking about last week, something to dissipate static. And they have the very creative tell you not mean a lightning arrest. I wonder though, if I do have static, does it or does it not make the antenna more prone to a lightning? I may buy that in the rate. $45, you have to have one ground rod. I know last time I had ground rods, Whitestone, called an electrician, and he hammered it into the ground. The device is called a Hilti, and I can tell you, Home Depot has been farming out contractors. Home Depot stands behind their work, and they were cheaper than anybody else. Back to you, Ned. Dick.
C2GS.
Roy recognized us. I'll put a couple of comments in and pass it right over to Roy. That is that ordinarily, a balun is a fairly rugged thing. If a lightning bolt struck in your neighborhood nearby and created an electromagnetic pulse into your antenna system, it is my belief that a simple toroid with some nice heavy gauge wire wrapped around it would survive that very nicely. A direct hit on your antenna, maybe not. However, with all the trees and power wiring and everything else in your neighborhood, the chances of your particular antenna being the thing directly struck with a lightning bolt is really an extremely rare event. We all think as radio amateurs, hey, I'm putting this shiny piece of metal in the air. My eye sees it immediately. The lightning must see it, and it's going to strike it immediately. We all think that. It's a rare event. So,
Repeater, time out.
So the chances of lightning having created this damage, if there is damage in that ballon, it's a slim possibility. And where the brand new ballon hasn't been subjected to that lightning bolt, and it behaves, the testing so far suggests that it's behaving identically to the new, to the old ballon, again would say that that's not the event that triggered all this. Because we now know that damage will occur when you've got a kilowatt amplifier going into a high standing wave ratio antenna. It can do damage to your antenna tuner. It can do damage to your Vizwa detecting circuit. It can do damage to a ballon. It can do all kinds of things. So on the conservative side, anybody using a high power antenna like that, a high power amplifier, should start off each day. Spend another 60 seconds, so to speak, and do a test where you put a low amount of power into your antenna system. Make sure it measures some reasonable level of standing wave ratio before you hit it with the destructive high power. You have to start off, if you want to be conservative and not burn up a lot of equipment, each one of us should start off, even though the antenna and the high power amplifier worked beautifully yesterday, something could have happened between yesterday and today. So if you want to be a belt and suspenders conservative person, do a quick test that the antenna has low standing wave ratio before hitting it with high destructive power. That's my suggestion. I'm pretty sure Rich, after going through this episode, is probably going to be doing that in the future. AC2GS, K2RIW, with comments and all of the above. You got it, Roy.
Yes, thank you very much, Dick. I just wanted to maybe suggest to Rich that Cobra itself kind of pretty much is promoting Ballon Designs Ballon. So if he feels the need to get a secondary Ballon, you might want to get one that's approved by Cobra. And getting back to that previous, I don't think it's quite as complicated as it sounded when you were describing it. How to calculate the complex impedance by resistance and the reactance is basically a right triangle, as you mentioned. It's a Pythagorean theorem. It's x squared plus r squared, the square root of the hypotenuse, if you will. And not only did I actually learned it when I was studying for my exams from Handy Ham, that taught you to do it in your head, but Mel, back about 10 years ago on this very technical net, K2KEY, did a little presentation based on a book of his for mathematics for electronics.
Okay, now you're right. The Pythagorean theorem, the right angle triangle, where one leg is the resistance, 200 ohms in this case, the other leg is the inductive reactance, 440 ohms in this case, and therefore you calculate what's the length of the hypotenuse. That's the total impedance. That comes out to be 483 ohms. So a 200 ohm resistor has a total complex impedance of 480 ohms. To now convert that into a standing wave ratio, I think many an amateur, without giving specific instruction, would be stopped at that very next step. At first you'd say 483 total ohms of reactance, a little more than twice the 200 ohms you desire. You would think you have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, but because a major component of that is reactive, and because reactive impedance behaves in a different manner, come up with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio when the real number is 6.6. So that last step to turn that complex hypotenuse total impedance into a standing wave ratio, I think many an amateur would be stopped on that one, is my guess, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, I agree with that. I used to use it as more simple things of not having to go through a 4-to-1 ballon that adds confusion to everything. And, you know, in my mind, most things are 50 ohms, so you just divide whatever number you get by 50 ohms and you get the ratio of VisWa. But in this case, you're quite right that it's a complicated matter because you have that 4-to-1 balance.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Go right ahead, Mr. VDH. And what you do with that crazy complex impedance, I'll give you guys a little bit more words on that after Mr. VDH. VDH, go right ahead. I should know your name. You sign it so often. Go right ahead, sir. K2RIW. Yeah, John. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, fine business. Good evening to all on the net. Yeah, I just wanted to mention two things. First of all, I think you suggested this a couple of weeks ago that maybe to try a half-wave balun, you know, made with a loop of half-wave cable, that'll give you a 4-to-1 that you'll be able to at least see if the SWR is still high. And if it is, then it's got to be something else. At least you can rule it out and test it out at the one frequency. I think you made that suggestion a couple of weeks ago. And the other thing about the SWR, well, work the whole thing in rectangular form, where the impedance, you keep it in rectangular form and then do the division, and you get a magnitude and angle for your reflection coefficient. And like you said, it's just 1 plus the magnitude of rho over 1 minus the magnitude of rho. So go ahead.
Yes, I'm pretty sure I did say the half-wave coax balun, which is an extremely rugged, reasonably broadband balun, broadband one band at a time, or maybe a 3-to-1 band ratio at a time, is a very good substitute. So at just 14 megacycles, or just 80 meters, to make a half-wave coax balun, a 4-to-1 device. You take a length of coax that's a half-wave length long at your operating frequency, bend it back into a U-turn, into a U-shape, connect the grounds together along with the ground of the main input coax cable, and then those two center conductors of that U are now 200 ohms, and feed one of them with the center conductor of the transmission line going into it. That half-wave coax balun, very rugged. I mean, that would probably survive a direct lightning strike sometimes, if you know what I mean. And so that would have been a good test to confirm or deny the antenna integrity. However, at that time, the standing wave ratio circuitry on the output of the antenna tuner had already been damaged. So that would have been a difficult test to do without another piece of equipment, like a bird watt meter. Let me drop.
M2VO again, Dick.
Don't worry, Rich, we'll be going back to you. So that would be, in fact, one other backup procedure. Bypassing all of the balance structures without spending very many dollars on pieces of coax cable, Rich could make a half-wave coax balun for 80 meters, a half-wave coax balun for 20 meters, if those are the two bands he's using, and plug in the right balun at the right time. The coax balun, almost nothing will destroy that, with rare exception. That's the one kind of balun in the world. You could feed it into an infinite standing wave ratio for 10 solid minutes with 200 watts of power, and it'll just sit there and laugh at you, you know what I mean? It won't damage itself. It's very, very rugged. So as a backup procedure, we probably should construct a couple of those coaxial balans for Rich. Let's see, that was one subject, the half-wave coax balun. Try to remember the second subject I mentioned, John, because I wanted to say some words on that. Tell me, John, what was the second subject? Major VDH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, I was saying that to do the SWR, if you keep the impedance in rectangular form, so it would be 200 plus J 440 as impedance. So you would do that that impedance minus the 200 ohms divided by 200 plus J 440 plus 200. So that since your Z zero is essentially 200 ohms, and so you would have a complex division to do. And that would give you your rho at an angle theta, which would be your reflection coefficient. Then just 1 plus rho over 1 minus rho for the SWR. So go ahead.
You sound like an engineer, John, and you've got to be one to give that answer. The complex impedance, 200 ohms of resistance plus J440, 400 ohms of inductive reactance, that is the Z, the complex impedance. And the formula is Z minus Z0 on top, and Z plus Z0, Z0 in this case is 200 ohms, what you desire, on the bottom. Divide that, and you end up with the complex division that gives you the exact reflection coefficient. And if you take the absolute value of that complex reflection coefficient, take the absolute value of it, which is then called rho, 1 plus rho over 1 minus rho is standing wave ratio. So there's a couple more steps in there that would slow down the average guy who hasn't been doing it. If somebody teaches you how to do it and you remember it and write down some good notes, but this is all doable. And in some cases, you wouldn't have to buy a fairly expensive antenna analyzer, if you know what I mean, as long as you can measure inductance and resistance separately with sometimes pretty simple equipment. So it's a good thing to know about. I'm guessing only 5% of the amateurs out there have the enthusiasm to go that far to calculate complex impedances, what's the real standing wave ratio, how many ohms of inductive reactance, how many microhenries and a dummy load can I tolerate? Let me drop this. Andy's Bird model dummy load, 50 ohm dummy load that he uses for the load on each piece of equipment that he's measuring at his tune-up clinic at each one of these flea markets. That dummy load made by Bird probably is good for a couple hundred watts, probably is good for well beyond 1,000 megahertz, and it's still very close to a pure 50 ohm resistor. That's a quality piece of equipment. And you have to lay down some cash in order to get that, but that's a handy thing to have. So if you're ever involved in this kind of testing and somebody at a flea market is sending a bird, selling you a Bird dummy load, it's a good thing to buy, even if it's a little bit pricey, in my opinion. Okay, over to Rich for a final on this subject. We're making progress there, Rich. 3 steps forward and 1.5 steps back. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNav.
Okay, Dick, and to Leo. When I lived in Whitestone, Queens, me and Barry had put up an antenna very, very high up on the peak of the roof. The highest thing in the area. Wasn't up there more than a few weeks and got struck by lightning. And I know it got hit because burn parts of the antenna was sitting in my neighbor's tree. So, that's a lesson. But right now, the antennas are not up that high, so I'm not going to worry. That time, that antenna was the highest thing in the area. I bought a watt meter dummy load. We got a watt meter with it. Nice MMJ. One of their new products, dry dummy load. So I'm going to use that permanently because I have a switch in the back to select an antenna or the dummy load. And I think it's rather nice. Anyway, back to you, Dick. I won't believe it. M2EO.
When Rich lived in Whitestone, Queens, where he's very close to the Whitestone, very close to the Verrazano Bridge, very close to the water, on a fairly high piece of land, not very many trees in the nearby property. So his antenna was the highest thing around, and yes, we'll get struck. Very similar to what happened with my grandfather's farm in Port Washington. He was on a hill in Port Washington, and his barn, one of his 3 barns, would be struck with lightning every third thunderstorm, if you know what I mean. So certain pieces of land are very vulnerable. Where Rich is right now, and I've seen his property, there's lots of tall trees around. His antenna is two-thirds of the way up the trees is where it's mounted, if you mean. It's mounted between 2 trees. So, and there's a whole lot of power wiring that's a higher altitude from Con Ed or Loco in his neighborhood. So the chances of his current antenna being struck is very slim. So you can make an estimation as to what's the probability of your antenna being struck by lightning, depending on the lay of the land. high 100 foot of tower on 300 feet above sea level land in Dix Hills. I am the local lightning arrester. You would think I'm going to be struck all the time. I've been here since 1969, and I think I did take one direct strike in all of those almost 50 years of living here, if you know what I mean. So it's not easy to predict. And that one lightning strike, I'm not even sure I was struck. I know that a lot of the neighbor's equipment had television sets and computers that were damaged. So I'm pretty sure the local power grid took the strike. We're going to go over now to the next person that signed in, which was Dave, Whiskey 2 Alpha Alpha Mike. Go right ahead, Dave. Sorry to keep you waiting. K2LIW in the tech net.
Hey, Joe, do you want to get a moment?
Roger. Are you there, Dave? While we're waiting for Dave to come up to the mic, KE2EJ, I can tell you've made a significant change to this particular antenna we're going through at the repeater, because I'm not hearing those blasts of noise in the background. So looks like you've made a huge improvement there, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, well, I think if you listen to Roy carefully, the problem that we've been having with him will probably have disappeared. Anyway, I have the, I tried to break in before to suggest to Andy that I have a whole bunch of non-inductive resistors. Every Wilkinson divider that I have here has a 250-watt 100-ohm resistor, which is used as part of that. So I have a bunch of them that are kicking around. I also have a V&A that beats the pants off of his nice little toy, but that's another story. Anyway, let me let it drop.
An ordinary Wilkinson, I think, requires a non-inductive 100-ohm resistor, if I'm right. Eric, go ahead.
I don't know if you heard me, but I said 100-ohm resistor. If you want to put 250 watts into it, you have to put it on a hunk of metal and take the heat away. But I've got 50-ohm and 100-ohm non-inductive, truly non-inductive. Although when I put them on the V&A, you see the length of the lead. It's really very tiny, but, and I also have a V&A that will do just about everything, so if he wanted to do that, I could set that up for him. He could actually bring the thing over here, we could take a quick look at it, and, with some pads and stuff, we could actually run some power into it and see what it's doing. But anyway, so the duplex that I pulled out, I have just measured the, earlier today I measured the rejection, or the isolation, and it drifted. The thing was down to around minus 60. Normally it should be about minus 90, which is kind of tough to get, but the duplex that I have in there now has isolation of around 100. And I was noticing some stuff during the rain yesterday that's making me think that maybe one of the jumpers, or maybe even the cable, got a little water saturated in it. I don't know at this point. I'm going to go up there with the TDR and take a look and see what the story is. But it's not windy, and it's nice and dry, and it's working real well. K2RAW, K2J.
Yes, my guess is it's working real well right now, and you measure the standing wave ratio with your bird, most likely, and it's probably reasonable. And although we had a lot of rain a couple of days ago, the water doesn't dry out of a cable that fast, so I think the cable could be reasonably well sealed. Looks like you're in good shape, and you've made a hell of an improvement. An isolation of 60, wow. That means 100 watts in would be a tenth of a watt going into the receiver, and that's a lot of power into a receiver. It's going to overload every receiver you own. 90, I think, is the bare minimum. 100 is what you'd like to have for isolation. And if you can get 110, it would be even better. The new isolator you put in, the new duplexing filter you put in there, to get 100, I'm guessing it could very well be a six-cavity duplexing filter. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
The one I pulled out is also six cavities. It's actually a little smaller, it fits in the rack. What I got in there now is a behemoth, and I nearly killed myself putting it up on the top of the rack. It's so damn heavy. But those around, this one is, is that canalized aluminum that you can screw together.
I checked all the millions of screws, although I'm trying to find an actual torque value for the screws. You know, the room that the duplex is fairly stable in terms of temperature. So, I mean, this has happened before with this particular duplexer, so... And actually, it wasn't the main tuning, it was the reject tuning with your little capacitors. For some reason, it just drifts. So, when I returned it, I got it back to about minus 90. I don't know whether I'm going to put it back or leave what I got in there, because the one that I have in there is 200. And that was on an IFR, which I don't really believe goes down. They say it goes to minus 110, but I don't believe it. At least the VNA that I had, I can do almost 130. So I didn't get a chance to put it on this piece of gear because it was a matter of get the damn thing out of there and make the repeater work better.
Yeah, some of the better vector network analyzers, like Rodin Schwartz, allows you to select the resolution bandwidth of the instantaneous measurement as it sweeps across the band. And if you set that to a narrow number and sweep slowly, sometimes you can go down to some pretty nice numbers like minus 110, minus 120 of rejection being displayable on that screen. Vector network analyzer is a really a beautiful thing. There was another comment I was going to make about that. So the little trimmer capacitor that gives you the last little bit of isolation, you think that that drifted? I don't think so. In other words, if you had set that at 0.1 picofarad, did it suddenly become 0.2 picofarad? Very unlikely. It turns out the exact tuning you do for the bandpass filters for the receiver and the bandpass filters for the transmitter, never twice you're going to get them to the exact same setting when you're peaking those. The minor error in those peaks make the requirement for the trimmer a little bit different. So an extremely small percentage of change. Let me drop this. This is a bunch of speculation on my part. An extremely small change, 0.001%, in the exact tuning of the bandpass filters for receiver and bandpass filters for transmitter will change the requirement for the isolation trimming capacitor considerably. In other words, the main tuning capacitor, which has got, let me pick a number, 20 picofarad doing the resonance, and it changes by 0.1 picofarad, all of a sudden your isolation trimming capacitor has to go from 0.1 to 0.2 picofarads. It's a big change there, even though the real causative agent for that change is something very, very small at the original filter. That's what I think is going on. And the screws that now you're talking about, that you want to torque on the new isolator, I hope those are not at the base, the grounded end of those cavities. That's a very critical area. I'd like to have micro-ohms of impedance there if you can get it. And I hope, although the temperature is reasonably well controlled in this environment, I'd like to believe that it's not a high humidity environment at times, but that may require a sealing of the upper chamber, and it might require a dehumidifier, and maybe all of that's not there. KE2EJ, K2RIW, New TechNet.
Now, one thing, don't forget, this is a bandpass failed to reject. What the trimmers do is they null the opposing frequency. This is made out of this prefab metal. So these cavities are rectangular, they're not round. The pieces of metal slide together. You know, they're channelized, and then in each one of the channel is a self-tapping screw. And once I find out what the right torque value is, I can tell you whether or not the plate is torqued evenly or not, because you can take all the screws out and you wind up with looking right into the bottom of the cavity, as opposed to the round ones where the both the top and bottom are brazed to the pipe itself. So there's a number of different variables, but based upon the path loss of the bandpass part, which is about exactly the same as it's always been, and the path through it, I think, is about 1.52 dB, and it appears to be that hasn't moved. I think this thing has, made it 5 to 20 pop caps across each loop, and they're really cheap trimmers, so... it's not like they're high high efficiency, well made piston trimmers in this particular thing. That's why I question that.
If you took the tuning of those bandpass filters and disturbed them and then readjusted them to what you think is the right setting, I think you would find that the trimmer capacitor to give you the best rejection might require a slightly different setting. That would be an interesting experiment to do. There's another comment I was going to make about the duplexer. Oh, yes. With self-tapping screws, you got to be careful. A self-tapping screw going into a big piece of metal, each time you plug it in, it's doing a little bit more machining of the material. A real machine bolt with a bolt and a nut and a lock washer, you can put that in a zillion times and properly torqued, it'll give you repeatable results. But a self-tapping screw, that scares me. Don't take that apart very often, because you're re-machining that hole each time you put in a self-tapping screw. The first time you put them in, they're beautiful. Second and third time, they can get a little bit ratty, in my opinion. One of the crazy things I ran into once, let me drop them.
I'd be out of your mind if you're going to take those screws out.
You'd be out of your mind taking those screws out and putting them back in and think that everything's going to come back to where it was. The new chips you're making would be underneath that piece of metal and creating a spacer and whatever. You wouldn't be good in good grounding. So self-tapping is a quick and dirty way of doing it. I wish that was a real tapped hole blind fastener. That would be repeatable. We had the blind hole fasteners on this cavity filter that was being used at 8 gigahertz at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and it was silver plated. That's the good news. Everything in there was silver plated. But each time you plug those machine screws into those holes, the screws themselves, somebody had silver plated them. Each time you unscrewed those screws, if you looked with a good microscope, you found out you made a spiral chip each time you unscrewed one of those screws. And when those spiral chips fell into this air cavity system, at first everything's hunky-dory. You put a zillion watts through this high-power filter and tap on it with the wooden end of a screwdriver, those little spiral silver-plated things that come off the screws, jump up in the air, created a short circuit, and the whole filter would arc over. And that was happening during air flight because the airplane was creating the vibration that rattled those things up. And so you try telling people that when you're taking these screws out in order to retune that filter, and you're making these chips, that without a microscope you don't even see them, but they're going to create an arc over of a kilowatt network at some later time during a flight test. You try to convince people that was a causative agent, and they would say, what planet were you born on? They really misunderstood the problem. You see what I was talking about there, Eric? The tiniest little whisker of silver as a spiral going between, in a high voltage point of a high power cavity, creates an arc.
Repeater, timeout.
It creates an arc, and once that arc is created, the only way you can get rid of that arc is with an extremely high power blast of something like sulfur hexafluoride, or by turning off the transmitter. Neither one of those were available. Do you see how something that your eye cannot see without a microscope, how it can create a huge amount of damage in a high power network? KE2EJ, I bet you as a broadcast engineer you've seen some of the things on some of your stuff. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, KE2EJ. I could tell you some funny stories about the 60 kilowatt transmitter, but I'll save that for another time. First of all, you know, nobody's going to be unscrewing this stuff. And actually, I'm looking a little closer at it. It may actually be, they're machine screws, and that's self-tapping screws. Whether or not they threaded the channels for them or not, I couldn't tell you. Well, I'm not about to find out. Just think of this as a big rectangle with a plate on top and a plate on bottom. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 screws on each side of the rectangle. They give you a little concept of what it looks like. You know, it's extruded aluminum. That's the kind of thing where you could use these things to make your own boxes and stuff like that. But anyway, this I got to look it up. There's probably an actual torquing value for these screws, and to just check it and make sure that it within range of what it's supposed to be. I guess that would kind of ensure, you know, a proper even contact across the four faces of the rectangle. But that's something to be found out. But anyway, I'd be curious during the science